used to go to, they have a blog that has brought a number of things to my attention that I wanted to look at this morning. And as Matt has invited us to share the things that are speaking to us, that we share those with you. It is my hope that as we go through this, there is going to be some hard parts, but there is hope. And I will lay the groundwork of difficulty before we talk about the hope. Steve, I thought especially you'd appreciate this slide because of the math symbols on there, the inequalities. But if there was one place to start, especially today, after all the things we've talked about, that fear does exist. Choosing fear does not equal safe. My story today is going to talk about the children of Israel, the Exodus, the building of that nation. But I understand this whole concept of fear and how that can motivate us. And I think my challenge to you would be, as we go through some of this, listen to some of this, read some of this, there might be places you can identify with. But as we look at the reactions of the Israelites to God's leading, I think we can see their responses are, in many parts, reaction to fear, that's the underlying issue we're dealing with. I know that's a lot of things that have motivated me in the past, and I'm learning to move past fear. Part of that, thank you, Matt, for giving us some reminders, are setting up Ebenezers. Matt has talked about this a couple of times in talking about Samuel. So the title that I'm going to kind of work from today is Looking Back to Look Forward. And again, I say that this is as much to me as it is to hopefully helpful to you, that as we look back, that we see God's glory, God's provision. And sometimes we have to look back at the hardships that we have brought upon ourselves sometimes because we've chosen fear instead of love. And we've forgotten that perfect love casts out fear. So we look back a little bit. Matt's been covering some ground about the Israelites, about Samuel. The rock, the Ebenezer, is something that's been a picture for me that I've thought about many times. And so as we look back, we're going to look back a little bit so that we can look forward. But looking back at Israel's struggle to become a people of God and a nation, they cried out to God. Just for a little history, the Israelites are in Egypt. They cried out to God, and he hears them. He raises up Moses to lead them out after an amazing show of power, he does so. You know, we read about those plagues that Moses brought forth for the Egyptians to see and Pharaoh to see, and wondering, how in the world did they not get it? And sometimes we can look past those and just read them and think, yeah, those are really gross, flies and gnats and frogs and boils and hail. And we're thinking, why didn't Pharaoh get it? But I wonder if maybe this show was not so much for Pharaoh, because it talks about God hardening Pharaoh's heart. Maybe this was to try and prepare the Israelites for that they needed to see God's show of power to lead them through something he was going to make difficult for them, to lead them out of Israel. Even after all of these plagues that are brought down in Egypt, you would think that people would get it. But we hear after they just start their journey, they struggle with God, they struggle with Moses, and they struggle with each other. Now, to be fair, they've got some logistical challenges. The estimate is, the one count that we see is 600,000 men, leading to somewhere between 2.5 and 3.5 million people. Now, I don't know anybody that's tried to organize that sort of movement of people. There are some logistical challenges, to say the least. Can you imagine even dealing with the waste that might be produced by this large of group? How many Santa cans would you have to help that sort of thing? Sort of gross, but that's a huge undertaking. Now, God did give them some miraculous items. He did give them a pillar of fire providing light, a pillar of cloud that provided shelter and water, and he also, very cool, especially in a house where we buy a lot of shoes, their shoes didn't wear out. Now, how cool is that? Granted, they would be robbed of some Christmas presents, but that is a great thing. So as I started to look at this, one of the things that I was struck with as I read through Numbers and Exodus, I came upon scripture in Numbers 14. And I'll read this. So I just put the words up there. So doing multimodalities in my message this morning. By the way, we need to pray for the technology. Hopefully that works, because if it doesn't, I'm going to be picking on some of you to do some reading. But as I'm reading through this story, they come to a major challenge, and the Lord replied. He's talking to Moses. There's a particularly difficult task that they've just witnessed, and this is God's reply to Moses. The Lord replied, "I have forgiven them." Again, they've messed up. Moses asks for God to quell his anger, and the Lord replied, I have forgiven them as you have asked. Nevertheless, as surely as I live and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of those who saw my glory and the signs I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their ancestors. Not one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it. And I was thinking, wow, 10 times. I thought, yeah, I remember some of the stories that of their grumbling and complaining. And I said, you know, I want to go back and look at that. I don't remember 10. But sure enough, as I started to look, there was at least that. And these are the ones we only have recorded. But I wanted to kind of throw these out there and ask that hopefully this works. I'm going to have these read by they're basically a MP3 file that plays, so you don't have to try and read this. Hopefully this will work. We'll give it a try. These are some of the responses of the people as they're moving out of Egypt. And the very first one is before they've even crossed the Red Sea.
As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up and saw them, Egyptians, coming at them. They were totally afraid. They cried out in terror to God. They told Moses, "Weren't the cemeteries large enough in Egypt so that you had to take us out here in the wilderness to die? What have you done to us, taking us out of Egypt? Back in Egypt, didn't we tell you this would happen? Didn't we tell you, leave us alone here in Egypt? We're better off as slaves in Egypt than as corpses in the wilderness."
They haven't even got to the Red Sea yet, and yet they're already looking back. And I think what they're looking back to, for some reason, appeared more attractive than what God was doing in front of them. So we haven't even crossed the Red Sea yet, and they're already complaining.
Moses led Israel from the Red Sea onto the wilderness of Shur. They traveled for 3 days through the wilderness without finding any water. They got to Marah, but they couldn't drink the water at Marah. It was bitter. That's why they called the place Marah, bitter. And the people complained to Moses, "So what are we supposed to drink?"
So we've got a physical need here that they're concerned about, but really what they're probably afraid of is, can we trust you, God? We've seen the plagues. You've brought us through the Red Sea, dry land. We've seen Pharaoh's army eaten up. 3 days later, after crossing the Red Sea, the pillar of fire is there. Everything you would think would be there to help them, and yet they're afraid of not finding enough water. So that's 3 days after. Here's 6 weeks after.
On the 15th day of the second month, after they had left Egypt, the whole company of Israel moved on from Elim to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. The whole company of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron there in the wilderness. The Israelites said, "Why didn't God let us die in comfort in Egypt, where we had lamb stew and all the bread we could eat? You've brought us out into this wilderness to starve us to death, the whole company of Israel."
So what is their fear this time? Are they going to have enough to eat? Are we going to have enough to drink? Are we going to have enough to eat? That's only 6 weeks after they've witnessed everything so far. See if you can, I think you'll all remember this one.
Directed by God, the whole company of Israel moved on by stages from the wilderness of Sin. They set up camp at Rephidim, and there wasn't a drop of water for the people to drink. The people took Moses to task, "Give us water to drink." But Moses said, "Why pester me? Why are you testing God?" But the people were thirsty for water there. They complained to Moses, "Why did you take us from Egypt and drag us out here with our children and animals to die of thirst?" Moses cried out in prayer to God, "What can I do with these people? Any minute now they'll kill me."
Now again, we're not talking about a small camping trip. We're talking 2.5 to 3.5 million people. And you can imagine why Moses is starting to feel the weight of this. And yet, still, there's that fear that God is not enough, that what we've seen is not enough. And where does it lead them?
When the people realized that Moses was taking forever in coming down off the mountain, they rallied around Aaron and said, "Do something. Make gods for us who will lead us. That Moses, the man who got us out of Egypt, who knows what's happened to him? So Aaron told them, take off the gold rings from the ears of your wives and sons and daughters and bring them to me. They all did it. They removed the gold rings from their ears and brought them to Aaron. He took the gold from their hands and cast it in the form of a calf, shaping it with an engraving tool. The people responded with enthusiasm, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up from Egypt.
So we've got the whole golden calf thing, the idol, but the thing that strikes me that's so disturbing here is that they're looking at Moses at the mountain where Moses is called up to, and it's a fiery, billowy mountain, and that should have been enough, you would think. Not only did the 40 days wear them down to where they didn't trust anymore that Moses could lead them, but they actually believed a lie that it wasn't God or Moses who brought them out. It was this golden calf. That takes fear to a whole new level that it really clouds our perception. I'm going to talk about perception in a little bit, but somehow they're missing the clues on the outside that is leading to a demise on the inside of their trust and their ability to follow God.
The people fell to grumbling over their hard life. God heard. When he heard, his anger flared. Then fire blazed up and burned the outer boundaries of the camp. The people cried out for help to Moses. Moses prayed to God, and the fire died down.
So now we hear God being a little frustrated with them as well. The people fell to grumbling over their hard life, and yet what started this whole thing was grumbling over their life in Egypt. They were so close at this point, too. You'd think, okay, 40 years, these amount of complaints, that's not so bad. But realize these complaints that we're looking at happened in the first year and a half of their time away from Egypt, that most of this took place in the very first beginnings of trying to bring them out of where they were. And they were right up at the edge to where they could have crossed over into the promised land within 2 years. But as we'll find out, the story gets a little longer and harder, and it's not because of God, it's because of how they responded to God.
Look, God, your God, has placed this land as a gift before you. Go ahead and take it now. God, the God of your fathers, promised it to you. Don't be afraid. Don't lose heart. But then you all came to me and said, let's send some men on ahead to scout out the land for us and bring back a report on the best route to take and the kinds of towns we can expect to find.
So they're right on the edge, 2 years in. They're right there where they could have crossed over. And they found, okay, to quell our fear a little bit, let's go check this out. Can God be trusted? And can we actually do this? So what do? They send spies into the land to check it out, and they're gone 40 days. And when the spies come back, there's some interesting things that happen, some dynamics, and how the people chose to respond to them. So here's the report that came back that the people believed. Even though this report came in two different ways it took, the people believed what they wanted to believe, and they stayed right with that same fear.
But the others said, we can't attack those people. They're way stronger than we are. They spread scary rumors among the people of Israel. They said, we scouted out the land from one end to the other. It's a land that swallows people whole. Everybody we saw was huge. Why, we even saw the Nephilim giants, the Anak giants, come from the Nephilim. Alongside them, we felt like grasshoppers, and they looked down on us as if we were grasshoppers. The whole community was in an uproar, wailing all night long. All the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The entire community was in on it. Why didn't we die in Egypt or in this wilderness? Why has God brought us to this country to kill us? Our wives and children are about to become plunder. Why don't we just head back to Egypt? And right now, soon, they were all saying it to one another. Let's pick a new leader. Let's head back to Egypt.
The thing came to mind when I was going through this part was I don't know if you remember that when Keith Green was ministering and singing, he has a song called So You Want to Go Back to Egypt, which is a great song. And I really probably could have played that for these 10 complaints. But there's this whole concept of looking back and seeing, ugh, maybe that wasn't so bad. This uncertainty looking forward is very hard to take. So we've got the complaints of the people. We've got fear that comes out in many different ways. They just can't trust that what lies ahead of them is God's provision for them. And how does this affect Moses? How does this affect God? So I wanted to take a look at some of their responses to some of the complaints of the people. Moses heard the people of every family wailing, each at the entrance to his tent. The Lord became exceedingly angry, and Moses was troubled. He asked the Lord, "Why have you brought this trouble on your servant? What have I done to displease you that you put the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I give them birth? Why do you tell me to carry them in my arms as a nurse carries an infant to the land that you promised on oath to their forefathers? Where can I get meat for all these people? They keep wailing to me, 'Give us meat.' I cannot carry these people by myself. The burden is too heavy for me. If this is how you are going to treat me, put me to death right now. If I have found favor in your eyes, do not let my face go down to ruin." So here we have the birth of the sentence, "Kill me now." A common phrase that gets thrown around. But Moses was even so burdened by this that he says, "I can't take this." One of the cool things that happens, though, is how does God respond to this particular incident? But in this case, he raised up the church. He brought out 70 men from amongst the 2.5 million and said, "I will give some of my spirit to them to take care of some of these burdens." What a gracious God to say, "Moses, you need help." And I think about that sometimes at our church, too, and think, well, probably Matt and Sarah are probably feeling like, we can't carry this all ourselves. We need some help. And maybe this is one of the challenges here for me, too, was to say, God has poured out his spirit on us to help, and we can be assistants. Matt, I'm glad you had a good week off. And Sarah, thank you for taking responsibility for worship. You have a very worshipful presence. You bring us to the place where we can hear every week, and I appreciate what you're doing. I think we all do. But what a great picture that God took Moses's emptiness and said, "I'm going to take some of my spirit that's on you and give it to these 70 men." So he raised up the church. And here's some of God's responses. God said to Moses, "How long will these people treat me like dirt? How long refuse to trust me? And with all these things I've done among them, I've had enough. I'm going to hit them with a plague and kill them. But I'll make you into a nation bigger and stronger than they ever were." God is getting fed up with this. He says, "Moses, I can trust you. I'll build a new nation out of you." God spoke to Moses and Aaron, "How long is this going to go on, all this grumbling against me and by this evil-infested community? I've had my fill of complaints from these grumbling Israelites. Tell them, as I live, God's decree, here's what I'm going to do. Your corpses are going to litter the wilderness, every one of you 20 years and older who was counted in the census, this whole generation of grumblers and grousers. Not one of you will enter the land and make your home there, the firmly, solemnly promised land, except for Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and Joseph, son of Nun." Hold on to those two names. We're going to come back to those. But in this case, who did he talk to the most here? Those that had seen it. The adults in this case got it wrong. And so all of those 20 years and older are going to get exactly what they feared. They are not going to make it to the promised land, and they will die in the wilderness. And they could have gone over at that two-year period. All this happens in a very short period of time, and from that point forward, it's 19 years till we hear anything else about them. They're still wandering and thinking, how much is really going on here in that time? We don't have a lot going on, but maybe they got the message. Maybe they got the hint that, you know, what we've been doing hasn't been working. Living by fear is not helping. And yet we do find another event partway through this where Moses struggles with actually some of the religious leaders of the time. This is where Korah rises up against Moses. They have a squabble, basically, amongst who should have the power. Moses wins this battle, and Korah and all of his cronies are swallowed up by the earth and burned to death. Not a great way to respond. Partway through this now 38-year period from when they had the chance to cross over to when they finally do cross over, we see the breakdown again, or we see jealousy or envy creeping in, some of our weaknesses. So God and Moses are both upset. And another 19 years go by until we hear another entry. And this is the part that's hard to think about, because you think Moses did all he could to do it right. He had a great one-on-one conversation with God in many, many places that gave him strength. And yet he gets to a point where Moses even fails. People are grumbling and complaining again. It's about water again this time. So Moses took the staff away from God's presence as he was commanded. He and Aaron rounded up the whole congregation in front of the rock. Moses spoke, "Listen, rebels, do we have to bring water out of this rock for you?" With that, Moses raised his arm and slammed his staff against the rock. Once, twice, water poured out. Congregation and cattle drank. God said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not trust me, because you did not treat me with holy reverence in front of the people of Israel, you too aren't going to lead this company into the land which I am giving them." These are the waters of Meribah, bickering, where the people of Israel bickered with God, and he revealed himself as holy. Now you think, isn't that hard on Moses? Wasn't he trying to do everything right? Is this just a point where Moses is so worn down? But you notice in the first part of that, "Listen, rebels, do we have to bring water out of this rock for you?" God asked him to touch the rock with the staff once. And it said Moses slammed it against it twice. Moses takes the staff that earlier in the journey miraculously budded, showing who was for God. And in his weakness, he did not obey God. God asked him to strike the rock. What did Moses do? He hit it hard. But for whatever reason, he did it twice. Subtle, yes, but God revealed himself as holy. Wow, this is messy business, this nation building. And it's perilous. This brief overview kind of doesn't do justice to the whole thing, and there's so many other rabbit trails we could go on. But one of the things that struck me on here too, maybe this is a rabbit trail, interesting study of numbers here. There were 10 plagues in Egypt. How many commandments did the Israelites get?
10.
How many complaints did the Israelites give to God?
10.
So we've got 10 there. That's an interesting number. 40 is another one. 40 days Moses was on the mountain, and what happened? Fell apart. 40 days the spies are in the land, reconning the promised land, and actually some of them came back with, indeed, this does flow with milk and honey. We'll hear in a minute. 40 years they wander because they rebelled against God's favor. Ungrateful, short on memory, therefore they'll get what they feared, to die in the wilderness, and they won't see the promised land. One of the interesting things that we heard this last week in Alpha, the speaker talked about the Old Testament, and he used the single word as promise. And we have to step back from some of these stories where many times we find ourselves and remember that the Old Testament really does characterize a promise by God to lead his people. And yet we still deal with fear, we still deal with our weaknesses. You know, I think many of us can find ourselves in some of these struggles when we look at the obstacles that are in front of us and think, no way God can do that. Let me go back to comfort and safety. So, Moses is now not going to make it. Aaron's not going to make it. What do we have left? Who's going to lead the people? How does God lead his people in the continual story of the promise of the Old Testament? We have rises and falls, many of them. And typically what he calls out of the mass of confusion and difficulty is what? A faithful remnant. You remember the two names I read a minute ago about who will actually cross over? Caleb and Joshua. It's interesting how when Moses talks to Caleb, or talks to Joshua, he actually changes his name on the fly. Joshua's name was actually Hoshea, if I pronounced that right, which means salvation. Moses calls him out as Joshua, which means he is salvation. Caleb is characterized by a man with a different spirit by God. So these two men that have experienced everything else that everybody else did, the 2.5 million that Moses and Aaron saw and everything else, God calls these two as a faithful remnant to lead his people, because Moses and Aaron aren't going to cross over. And I'm sure many others along the way and looked back and tried to figure this whole thing out. And somehow God had not been enough for them. Somehow God had become commonplace. And somehow the bite and sting of life in the past seemed to be better than what appeared to be uncertainty looking forward. How long does it take for us for God to become commonplace? It appeared to take the Israelites not much more than 40 days. After 40 days with Moses on the mountain, again, a fiery, billowy mountain, they are ready to say, "Give us an idol. Oh, by the way, really, it was this idol that brought us out of Egypt, not Moses and his God." How long does it take us to say, "God, what have you done for us lately?" Does God become commonplace in our lives? That was one of the convicting things that struck me in this, is that, you know, we tend to go from highs and lows ourselves, and it's not hard for the patterns to lead to a furtherness from God, not feeling close in our prayers, not getting much from Scripture? And do we, at that point, has God become commonplace? So again, keep that in mind of looking back to look forward, that we have significant events in each of our lives where we can, sure, find hardship, but I believe we can find the promise of God too. They seem like the Israelites had a perception problem. Clearly, they could not see. Sorry, that's not a pun. But perception is a word that we use a lot in our house, and the definition is insight or intuition gained by perceiving, or the process by which an organism detects and interprets information from the external world by means of sensory receptors. So we can take in the information that's in front of us in the physical world, and a lot of times we can be beat up by what we see. If the Israelites' physical perception was so diluted or dulled, what about their spiritual perception? How long does it take to follow after that? And you know, I don't think we're called not to look back. In fact, Jesus in Luke 9 asks the man to follow him, and the man says, "I will follow you, Lord, but first let me say farewell to those at home." Jesus answers him, "No one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God." I wonder if Jesus was looking back to the wilderness story of the Israelites. And really, it's not a problem to look back, but what we are looking back for. Are we looking back for the weaknesses or the reasons not to follow? Are we looking back to find the promises of God and choosing to move forward? So let's look at these. I remember I mentioned Caleb and Joshua, and I'd like to contrast now how people can respond differently to the same set of circumstances. This is how God, remember the spies went out, they were in the promised land, they were scouting out the promised land, they were there for 40 days, they found all the things that God had promised, milk and land flowing with milk and honey. In fact, they brought back a cluster of grapes that was so large that two people had to carry it between them, two men. But the account came back and the people chose to respond to it in different ways. But I want to bring out what Caleb said about this account too. They gave Moses this account. "We went into the land as you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is the fruit." Again, the big bushel of grapes. "But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large." Now, these are some of the spies that went out, and this is how they characterized what they saw. "We even saw descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev, the Hittites and the Jebusites, and the Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live near the sea along the Jordan." Caleb steps up because he saw a different thing when he was there. Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, "We should go up and take the possession of the land, for we can certainly do it." Now again, here's Caleb who has seen everything that everybody else has seen, the progression to that point. He went out and saw the land, and he saw it with a different lens, a different perception. So there's this contrast between how the people characterized this recon mission they were on. Then Moses and Aaron fell face down in front of the whole Israelite assembly and gathered there. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothing. They were upset. And they said to the entire Israelite assembly, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will devour them. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid." Interesting how Caleb speaks to that fear, and he chose not to be ruled by it. Both Moses and God are troubled by this response of the spies and how the people are complaining and bickering. Moses intercedes for the people because God wanted to wipe them out, but those who spread the bad report about the recon mission were struck down and died of a plague. Caleb and Joshua are spared of this plague. This is how God describes Caleb. "Because my servant Caleb has a different spirit and follows me wholeheartedly, I will bring him into the land he went to, and his descendants will inherit it." Are we people of a different spirit? Do we look at these fears around us and these things that appear to be obstacles and rebel, look back to the safer days? Or do we try to look past the obstacles and look for God's guiding and leading us? Okay, Bad news. We're done with the hard parts. We have a remnant. We have two people who are called out to lead forward. What I'd like to finish with here today is to contrast some other people who saw hardship and difficulty. And they chose to look at their situation with hope and with expectation of God's providing for them. You know, Matt's been talking to us a bit about Samuel these past few weeks. Samuel was one of the faithful remnant in God's story of the Israelites. And how did he do it? How did he bring the Israelites back together? He did it through teaching and prophecy, right words, right actions, right beliefs that unite the people once again. But there's an interesting story in Samuel's life about Hannah, his mother. Samuel's mother had her own journey to take. And even though it was hard and she had reason to be bitter, she looked at her. She was barren. She could not bear children. But she put the matter before God. So I'm going to have Mary and Rachel read a couple of these.
In her deep anguish, Hannah prayed to the Lord, weeping bitterly. And she made a vow, saying, Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head. So in the course of time, Hannah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, because I asked the Lord for him.
Completely different reaction to a hard set of circumstances. Because I asked the Lord for him. What if the Israelites had asked God for their provision, for faith, for hope, for lack of fear? But it seemed that they kept looking at the externals. And Hannah could have been really selfish about that. She got pregnant. She was given a son, and she says, if you give me this son, I will give him back to you for your service. Wouldn't you think that after all those years of wanting to have children, and that was such a large thing in her community, that she would want to hold on to that for herself? But she gave her son up to be Samuel, a great leader for God. Because I asked the Lord for him. I'm going to have Mary read Hannah's prayer after. This is after Samuel was born. But see if you can, if this song of praise from Hannah after the birth of her son reminds you of a sermon that Jesus gave.
Then Hannah prayed and said, my heart rejoiced in the Lord. In the Lord my horn is lifted high. My mouth boasts over my enemies, for I delight in your deliverance. There is no one holy like the Lord. There is no one besides you. There is no rock like our God. Do not keep talking so proudly or let your mouth speak such arrogance, for the Lord is a God who knows, and by him deeds are weighed. The bows of the warriors are broken, but those who stumbled are armed with strength. Those who are full hire themselves out for food, but those who were hungry are hungry no more. She who was barren has borne seven children, but she has had many sons. But she who has had many sons pines away. The Lord brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and raises up. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and he exalts. He raises the poor from the dust, and he lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes and has them inherit a throne of honor. For the foundation of the earth are the Lord's. On then he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful servants, but the wicked will be silenced in the place of darkness. It's not by strength that one prevails. Those who oppose the Lord will be broken. The Most High will thunder from heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed.
So does that make you think of a sermon that Jesus gave? The Sermon on the Mount. So this is Hannah, 300 years after the children of Israel have entered into the promised land, and yet 1,000 years before Jesus is born. And her response, we can see, is much different. She looked at her circumstances, chose to ask God for her provision. He honors her, and then she praises God, even though knowing she's giving her son up to be in the ministry and not hold him at home. 1,000 years later, we have a story about John the Baptist and Elizabeth and Zechariah. I'm going to have Rachel read about this one. This is what Zechariah and Elizabeth were an older couple, very similar to Hannah, and yet they could not have a child. And Zechariah was working in the temple, and this is how God characterizes Zechariah and Elizabeth and how their story moves forward.
Both of them were upright in the sight of God, observing all the Lord's commandments and regulations blamelessly. But they had no children, because Elizabeth was barren, and they were both well along in years. Then an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing at the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was startled and was gripped with fear. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you are to give him the name John. He will be a joy and a delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth, for he will be great in the sight of the Lord." When his time of service was completed, he returned home. After this, his wife Elizabeth became pregnant and for 5 months remained in seclusion. "The Lord has done this for me," she said. "In these days, he has shown his favor and taken away my disgrace among the people."
Isn't it great that the angel, the first thing he says is, "Do not be afraid"? One of the first, obviously, difficult things that we deal with is fear. And what am I dealing with here, Zechariah says. And the angel says, "Fear not. Your prayers have been heard." Interesting how their response, you know, what does God say about them? He says that they were blameless and upright and following God's commands. This is 1,000 years after the children of Israel have crossed over into the promised land. And they obviously got it. They chose to serve the Lord in the temple. They believed, and yet they were also had a need that they were seeking God for. So that brings us to Mary, another person that God used, probably not even out of her own. She wasn't even complaining to God, saying, "I want to have a child. I'm a teenager. Hey, this is great. Why doesn't God just make me mother of Jesus?" Didn't even know what was about to become of her. And how did she respond to God's plan for her life?
"The angel said to Mary, 'The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will cover you. For this reason, the baby will be holy and will be called the Son of God. Now Elizabeth, your relative, is also pregnant with a son, though she is very old. Everyone thought she could not have a baby, but she has been pregnant for 6 months. God can do anything.' Mary said, 'I am the servant of the Lord. Let this happen to me as you say.' Mary got up and went quickly to a town in the hills of Judea. She came to Zechariah's house and greeted Elizabeth. When Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the unborn baby inside her jumped, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit. She cried out in a loud voice, 'God has blessed you more than any other woman, and he has blessed the baby to which you will give birth. Why has this good thing happened to me, that the mother of my Lord comes to me? When I heard your voice, the baby inside me jumped with joy. You are blessed because you believed that what the Lord said to you would really happen.'"
You are blessed because you believed that what the Lord said to you would really happen. We have different responses to obstacles, to things that come up in our life, and I wanted to leave you with the picture of that we have a choice to how we deal with fear and hard things. This week, it's hard not to be afraid. And I'm sure fear is gripping a lot of people in the community in Connecticut. A lot of people around my school last week were just numb. And how could you not be afraid? And yet, we have a challenge to how we respond to that. Do you notice the difference in the responses of Elizabeth and Hannah and Mary to God? Mary takes off running. She's so excited about Elizabeth being pregnant that she takes off and has to go see her. Was Elizabeth's future told to her any less miraculously than what the Israelites saw? Did she have a reason to doubt? What was said about Elizabeth and Zechariah? Did the Israelites have periods also when they followed the requirements? Mary and I learned a new definition of commitment last week in a class we were in. Maybe that is applicable here. And commitment was described as doing what you said you would do even long after the feeling that you said it in leaves you. So I'll read that again. Commitment. Doing what you said you would do even long after the feeling you said it in leaves you. Doesn't sound like the Israelites kept their commitments very well, because they went through the highs and lows. And in each one of those crises, there was a coming back. There was a saying, "We will do everything you've asked us to do, God." They had their best intentions. They had their up moments. But they had a hard time keeping their commitment. You know, Matt talked about Samuel responding to God and doing great works to bring the people together, and how Samuel erected a rock of remembrance, an Ebenezer, as it's called. Samuel said, "Thus far the Lord has helped us." So how is this a Christmas message? Hard things to think about on a day like this. But do you notice that these great celebrations are around a birth? Yet for Hannah and Elizabeth, while these children were certainly used by God, they're also satisfying a need and a hunger in their parents for a child. God does care about the desire of our hearts. Even though the complaints to God by the Israelites were painful, even for God, he did hear them and respond to them as a loving father, a God caring for a nation of people, God keeping his promise to Abraham. God has already given us great gifts. I think you and I can look back in some of our lives and see those places, and I challenge you to set up those physical or mental Ebenezers to look back on. He will continue to do so. Remember those gifts. Thanks. Have a great week. Thank you for being a gracious audience. I felt like I was among friends today.